if you're willing to persevere, there is always a way. I suppose maybe that's something that kind of I've learned as well, is just like, you can get hit with bad news and all of a sudden you can get kind of stressed and stuff like that, but if you just take a chill pill and just, you know, say, okay, well, look, there's always a solution.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. You can tell how excited I am about this week's episode and how much caffeine I've had. I'm chatting to Mr. Barry McNerney, the serial founder of incredible places like Paulie's Pizza, Junior's, Lots & Co., and now Unify Ordering, which is his new baby. This is an incredible interview. This takes you right through from 2008 to present day, and Barry has built, it's not a stretch to say, some of Dublin's most well-known restaurants and cafes, and now leading the way with a brand new tech company. I say brand new, it's been around since 2018, but it is on the way to greatness. If you're a fan of Paulie's, Junior's, you're going to love this episode. We dig into all the detail, how it happened, the challenges they faced, the crises they had, and the journey that got them to today, to their tech company called Unify. We get into all that in 1 second. But first, I want to thank my sponsors for season 7. First up, we have findavenue.ie. This does exactly what it says in the tin. If you're a corporate event organizer and you're looking to organize an event in the next 12 months, get on to Sean and his team at findavenue.ie. They will sort out the venue, they will sort out the entertainment, and they will also sort out a virtual venue, a virtual party, if you cannot make a physical event happen. And in today's world, that could not be more valuable as an option. Barry, welcome to the pod.
Gary, thanks a million for having me.
Pleasure to be sitting with you in this hallowed institution.
Yes, we're sitting in Barry's Bar, which is the upstairs of Paulie's Pizza. So it's the only place where I've got to get my name up in lights so far.
Anyway. So far. Anyone that's a Dublin native or has visited knows Paulie's. It's just an institution.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we opened here back in 2010 and it was one of the first places kind of doing wood-fired pizzas. There's a lot of them now, but back in 2010 we started, we wanted to do it to the association, to the standard that they have in Naples. So that's what we tried to do, and it's been a great success. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, spurred us on to lots of other ventures as well, so it's been a great stepping stone for
us. I'm going to start with a really easy question. What's the magic with Paulie's? Because it is just...
Well, like I said, we cook to the standard of the Vera Pizza Napolitana. So there's a couple of rules that they have in there. So you have to use 00 Caputo, but we use Caputo, but 00 flour. You have to cook in a wood burning oven at above 450 degrees Celsius. You have to use buffalo mozzarella on your margherita pizza, and you have to use San Marzano tomatoes for the pizza sauce. So it's really we're actually just using, you know, the standard that works. And we've just kind of brought that to Ireland. And I think the oven has a kind of a special, you know, character to it as well. And it seems to turn out good pizzas. And the guys who are working on the pizza oven are super fast and super efficient as well. So you're not waiting around and everything. It runs very well.
It's phenomenal. What was this your first venture?
No, the first venture that we did. So my background, I used to be an equity trader. I worked for a couple of big stockbrokers around town. And then in 2008, the financial crash happened. We would have worked a lot of time off brokerage fees. So, you know, based on the value of the share. So when I started in the stockbroking company that I worked with, you know, Bank of Ireland was trading at 20 euros a share. By the time I left, it was at 20 cents a share. So it had just been completely wiped out.
Wow.
So the kind of like my love for that industry kind of waned. But it wasn't so much that. It was more that I really always wanted to work for myself. And then my brother was a chef. So we just decided to, you know, get together and open a restaurant. We kind of looked at a couple of different places, and his fiance lived on Bath Avenue in Dublin 4. And this little cafe came free on 2 Bath Avenue. And I remember he rang me one day and said, look, this little cafe has come free. You know, we should go for it. And I said, okay, well, let's just do whatever the fuck we have to do in order to make this happen and whatever. Because we had no money. We had no nothing at all, you know. And we're just like, we'll do whatever it takes to get it. And we kind of went into this little cafe. We fitted it out with all our friends. A lot of our friends were kind of, you know, tradespeople who couldn't get work around 2008.
I was just going to say this was the start of the major crash.
Yeah,
2008.
Yeah, 2008 was
opening a restaurant. Okay, restaurant,
which yeah, but I mean, like a lot of people say, oh God, geez, you did really well to open during a recession. And I was just like, the only reason we did open was because of the recession. Because Previous to that, you would have been up against, you know, people paying key money and big kind of like chain landlords, you know, chain groups coming in for landlords. So we went in, we had no covenant, we had no trading experience, we had no nothing. And the landlord still took us on. And also then, you know, staff were really plentiful. And, you know, prices were cheap for goods and stuff like that. So thank God there was a recession, because that's how we got started. And I would say, you know, certainly looking at the restaurant industry in Ireland now over the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years ago, everything was bid up. You know, people were paying key money again. So perhaps, you know, now that there's might be, when these subsidies go off from the government, there's going to be a huge new space for new young entrepreneurs to come through. And I think, look, it might be a bad thing in the long run for kind of entrepreneurialism and new ventures coming through in the pipeline. But anyway, so we opened up this place, Juniors, in 2008. We had 20,000 euros of our own money. We kind of got leased for some kitchen equipment, and we fitted out for that, like, on a shoestring. And then we opened up, myself, my brother, and one kitchen porter. And we just got really lucky, really. I think what we were serving was really good food, because my brother's like a Michelin star chef. He's worked in really top places. And we were serving that in a very humble environment, kind of just, you know, IKEA chairs and tables. And it was quite cheap. And I think, you know, it was a backlash of after being the Celtic Tiger with all the excess. It was kind of like people appreciated, like, two young guys kind of working really hard, serving good food and kind of a nice...
Especially where you are on Bath Avenue, like, that's one of the most centrally located places in Dublin, really.
Yeah, and it's Dublin 4 now, and it's sort of, it's Ball's Bridge, but back then it was kind of more Ring's End, Irish Town, you know what I mean?
So it's rebranded itself.
It's definitely kind of changed the whole area since we first arrived. And it just, that was really successful. And then I think we started doing these New York style sandwiches at lunchtime, and all of the Leinster rugby teams started coming in, and then that was it. It just kind of really took off then.
What was the genesis of the idea behind it? Was it the New York kind of deli?
Well, when we first started, it was more, the dinner was more, that was the main thing. And then the lunch was kind of like just this side gig that we do at lunchtime.
Okay.
My brother and myself, actually, I'd worked in a restaurant called Grill on Georgia Street, or is it not on Georgia Street? Right beside the Olympia Theatre in the middle of town. I don't know, can't remember that. The name will come to me. You know,
Dame Street,
exactly. And they used to do these roasts in a row. So we just kind of wanted to do a similar type of thing, and we kind of did a variety of different sandwiches. We did a sandwich called the Chargrilled Chicken, and that kind of became quite famous. People used to come from all over to have the Chargrilled Chicken.
Okay.
It's delicious. And yeah, it just really took off. And then really now we're in a situation where probably we're more well known for the lunches than we would be for the dinner. And that would be the mainstay of the business.
You mentioned it there, the Leinster players started coming in. Mm-hmm. Was there a tipping point you felt that Med, you know, Paulie's has the formula and has that secret sauce? What do you think the secret sauce was back with Juniors at the start?
I think one, it just feels, it doesn't feel contrived at all in there, especially back then. It felt like this is, you know, it wasn't like we were taking something that we'd seen in America and we wanted to kind of replicate it. It was all from ourselves, and people can taste that kind of authenticity in the product that you're doing. And I think it resonates with people. I just think we were at the right time, in the right place at the right time. When we first arrived there, the Aviva Stadium was getting done up, so there was no internationals. We're just up the road from where Google, there's probably 250 staff working in Google.
Yes,
there's nobody on Barrow Street. The gasworks was still half finished and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, within, you know, so the rest of the world was falling apart in 2008, but just in this particular neck of the woods was absolutely booming, you know, and like all of this tech scene was starting to arrive, and we were right at the crossroads, literally.
Was that why you arrived here? Was this why you picked Bath?
No, absolutely no. We just happened to be just in random place that we happened to see, you know. We was not calculated at all. We thought it was a decent enough area and we could probably do something. We kind of really thought maybe we can do something pretty nice here, make a name for ourselves, and then we'll move into the Golden Mile in town or whatever, you know. But just this area started to flourish, you know. All the people working in those companies would come down to Slattery's and stuff like that after work, be packed. I mean, we had people, we didn't used to take bookings when we first opened Juniors, so people would wait an hour and a half, 2 hours to get a table and things like that, you know, because, and there was very little else around. That kind of casual dining scene, you know, kind of funky environments was just, you know, wasn't that common, you know, back then. It's more,
you do forget that, right? You do forget how quickly things have changed.
Absolutely. And you kind of forget we had no social media, we had no smartphones. Even just back in 2008, I remember, like, we'd be trying to get things organized, and you'd have to ring 11811 to get all the information. Whereas now you can just literally Google it in seconds. So I don't. Sometimes you don't appreciate how good we have it now in terms of how much easier things are to pull.
It's amazing how quickly you forget, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
That's 2008. That is not that long ago.
13 years ago. Yeah, so it shows you how quickly the world is changing as well. You know.
So juniors started.
So juniors started it, and then there was another premises just around the corner, and it was kind of vacant. And I think Joe Berger and stuff might have been looking at it at the time, or had been in there, and they'd moved out. We were thinking, oh, we could do something really nice in there. And I was saying to my brother, like, we should do a bakery. And he's like, well, he doesn't really know how to bake. And then I said, well, you know, we should do a pizzeria. And Paul, my brother, had worked in Naples on the Amalfi Coast. And he used to drive his moped into Naples city centre, which is like the home of pizza. And he would go into all the best pizzerias, El Presidente and all these different ones in Naples. And we said we should do, you know, a wood-fired pizzeria there. Now, neither of us had worked in a wood-fired pizzeria. We just knew the type of one that we liked to taste.
I like it. Yeah.
So again, I think you were saying earlier on, you're more of a kind of a build it and let them come. Like about 2 days before we were about to open this restaurant, this crazy Italian guy, Giulio, came and, you know, lovely fella. But he came and he kind of brought his own, you know, dough recipe. And like 2 days before, literally he arrived when we started making these incredible pizzas, and we've been doing them ever since. But I mean, it was very fortunate because if, you know, we were going to try and wing it and do it ourselves and stuff, but if he hadn't arrived, we would have been absolutely snooted.
So how far into your journey was this? How far after juniors was this?
That was in 2010. So we kind of like...
Not that long.
No, I've kind of a rule that I like to open a business maybe every 2 years. I think every year it takes about 6 to 9 months to iron out all the kinks. And then, you know, hopefully you might make a few bob, then like get your investment back over the next 6 to 9 months. And then probably another few months just to recharge your batteries, and then you can go again. I think if you do any more than one every 2 years, which I have been a victim of, I've done it and I've paid the price, you know, you're overstretched, you know, emotionally, financially, all the rest of it. And it's just, it can lead to too much stress. So
every 2 years, all the entrepreneurs listening are just their head in their hands now going, Barry, tell me how.
Yeah, well, every 2 years. So we opened here in 2010. It went quite well. Then we, that flew. And then in 2013, we extended upstairs in 2012. And then in 2013, we opened the old spot gastro pub with two other guys from the Bath pub, who are just down the road. And the idea, I always think it's really important to tell the story of why you're doing something. You know, you create a narrative, not just even to kind of for yourself, to kind of get a sense of it. Also, if you're talking to investors or if you're talking, I mean, you need to tell them the story of why, and this is why it made sense. But the story around that was that we were, myself and Paul, had a couple of restaurants in this area and we knew it really well. The guys in the Bath ran a really great bar, and we just kind of wanted to combine our powers, Captain Planet style, to
the Avengers of Bath Avenue,
so that they would bring all of their experience and their knowledge in relation to how to run a really great bar, and we'd kind of bring our experience on how to run a really great restaurant, and we'd launch a really great gastro pub together. And we did. We launched in 2013, and then it went on to become one of the only two pubs, I think, in Dublin in the Michelin Guide. And it still is from here on in. Now, myself and Paul have subsequently exited from that business. But it was a great journey altogether. And then in 2015, we opened Lots & Co. Grocery in the same area. And the story behind that really was I started to feel, I think they brought in these electronic tills in the supermarket. And I think I was working one day and I finished work and I came, I was single at the time. You know, I scanned the goods through at the tills and just arrived home. And it was just like a totally unhuman experience. Mm. I didn't get to interact with anybody. And I'm kind of quite nostalgic in terms of my outlook on life. I remember going to like grocery stores when I was a kid and, you know, interacting and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to recreate that feel where you could go in, talk to the butcher, you know, what are you having for dinner, strike a bit of conversation, kind of create a sense of community in a way as well. And also there was nowhere between Sandymount and Dublin City Centre where you could pick up a nice piece of fish. So I kind of had this in my head, and a car showroom around the corner from us came free. And I was talking to a guy, John Byrne, who was a wine supplier in the restaurant. And I said, you know what would be really cool in there is if we kind of opened up a little proper grocery store, you know, and like good high quality stuff, you know, small producers here in Ireland. And he just turned around and said, well, look, if you're going to do that, I'm interested in investing. And the kind of conversation just kind of kept going. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, we were opening a grocery shop, which I knew nothing about.
That rueful shake of the head. Tell me about that.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, you have to understand that it's completely different psychology to a restaurant, first and foremost. So we kind of expected, and we kind of, obviously, as always, the job went way over budget and way over time and all this kind of stuff. We were caught in the back foot, all this kind of stuff, debts mounting all over the place. And we opened the grocery shop, and I thought it was going to be like a restaurant, because when you open a restaurant, the first 3 or 4 weeks are really busy because people have been seeing it and they want to come in and try it, you know? And we were expecting that, and we're like, okay, when we open the shop, we'll get a glut of money and then we'll be fine and we can pay off all our creditors and all this kind of stuff. But the psychology for a shop is completely different, because what you're really trying to do is people go and do their grocery shopping, you go and do your shopping to the same place pretty much all the time.
Oh yeah,
you don't even creature really, habit. You become a creature of habit. You don't even really know why you're doing it, but you're just like, I need to get something, and you just go, you're on autopilot. Yeah. So when you open a new grocery shop, you're trying to break people's trends where they normally would go and trying to create a new trend so that they'll continue to go to your place. So we opened the shop on South Ross Road, and it was just like a ghost town for the first 3 or 4 weeks. And
really?
The other problem is really that, you know, if you open a restaurant and it's quiet, you just stop ordering goods and you kind of keep it tight in the background. Whereas with a grocery shop, you've got to keep doubling down and restocking the shelves and stuff like that, because the death knell of any shop is if you walk in and it doesn't look abundant and full, you know. Yeah. You want it to be, I always say, like, you know, Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, where they run in and they're all eating out of the trees and all this kind of stuff. You want to like make it feel like this extravagant experience where everything, people will come in looking to have a look around and walk out with shopping. Whereas, you know, you couldn't do it. So we had to keep doubling down on the spend. So
what were you thinking though in those first couple of weeks? Because that probably was your first major setback.
It was. I thought I've just bitten off more than I can chew. And I was just like, yeah, that's it. I've rolled the dice again.
One more time.
One too many. And this is going to be it. And I just catastrophizing. Like, really, it was the first week that we opened there. It was the most unbelievably stressful experience of my entire life. And it certainly curbed my enthusiasm afterwards, in terms of not so much not wanting to open a new business, but just being a little bit more like, just watch yourself. Because the first week that we opened that shop, I actually lost a stone in weight in 1 week.
Wow.
Because I was working, I used to wake up at like 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd be finished work at 2 o'clock at night, because there's just a million and one problems. Because if you think about it, when you're opening a grocery shop like that, like what we're doing, where we're doing ready meals and all that jazz, it's like opening five different businesses at the same time, all of which have to work in conjunction with each other. So, and it was just a million and one problems that you just had to get through and fix and stuff like that. Because, you know, if your fruit and veg and your butcher counter, if the stuff starts to turn bad, you want it not turn bad, but not good enough to be look really well for presentation or for selling. You want to bring that into your kitchen, turn it into a ready meal, reproduce it for your deli. So all of the different areas. So it just took a huge amount of work. And then, you know, the first 3 or 4 months was just terrible, you know. And I remember at one point I was driving out to meet my kitchen fitter, who had like escalated the bill. So I had this document prepared where I was kind of arguing about the price that he was charging me. And I got a phone call from my accountant saying that, you know, we owe 40,000 quid to the tax man. And I remember sitting in my car on the side of the road just going, that's it, I'm snookered, like I'm goosed.
The only man you don't owe money to.
Yeah, and then I was actually had to go out and have a row then. I was like on my way to have a row with somebody else about, you know, a bill. And I got that call from my accountant, and I was just like, that's it. Like, I can't really put up with any much more than this. And then just very luckily, you know, November turned around and we started turning a profit. Then we had Christmas was better. And then January was even better than December. And it just turned a corner. And like, it was just because we had to learn the new psychology of a shop. And
I was just going to ask you, what changed, do you think?
People used to walk into the shop when we very first opened, and they want to spend money. They'd want to go in and shop. So they have bags with them ready to go. And then you see them walking around, and the journey wasn't done right, and they kind of feel uncomfortable. They didn't know what was going on. They'd leave with nothing. And so what it is if you walk into a restaurant, you're met by a maitre d' or a manager or whatever it might be. They bring you to the table. They put a menu in your hand. They pour you a glass of water, and all of a sudden, you understand the rules of the game, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas we were bringing people into the shop, we didn't have adequate signage. So all, if you, without you realizing within a shop, there's all these signs pointed, this is here, this is there, this is the way you want to go, this is it. So you kind of, people feel comfortable on the journey and they're subconsciously being told the rules of the game.
Yeah.
And we didn't understand that. And that was something that we had to learn very, very quickly. And I think that was one thing. And then it was just a myriad of problems and just like constantly knocking down all the dominoes that you needed to get to. And it's just like hard work, hard slog, perseverance. And we just turned it around. And then I think we had a great manager in there, Rory, who's kind of done a great job and stuff like that. And it just, you know, just takes time. Just takes.
I think it's heartening for people to hear that though, because, you know, you've had juniors, you had Paulie's, two great successes. You know, you're always fallible, aren't you? Even no matter how high you rise, you still have lessons to learn.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the other thing I would say is, if you're willing to persevere, there is always a way. There's always a solution, you know. And I suppose maybe that's something that kind of I've learned as well. Is just like you can get hit with bad news, and all of a sudden you can get kind of stressed and stuff like that. But if you just take a chill pill and just, you know, say, okay, well, look, there's always a solution. Maybe that solution for some people is just say, look, that's it, I'm done. But, you know, and that can be a grace in certain respects as well.
How do you balance not being too reactive with still getting it done, still making the decision? Because I think that's what cripples a lot of entrepreneurs, is that kind of paralysis in the middle where you're not sure what to do.
I don't really know. I mean, like, I suppose I've made plenty of the wrong decisions myself, you know, and reacted and stuff like that. I suppose you have to kind of trust yourself, use your experience, and try and keep it on the right path. The way I always explain it is, when you start any business, or if you're involved in any business, you're at one point, and your destination is at another point further along the road. And between those two points is a million and one decisions and questions that you have to do. And now, you know, if you keep continuing to make the wrong decisions, you'll just go off that path. But you will make the wrong decisions, but you just got to recognize that you've made the wrong decision, get back on the path to success. And that's just experience and just using your logic, I suppose.
When Lots & Co. was going through that difficult period, how did you balance juniors, Paulie's, and there?
Well, I was very fortunate that my brother is my business partner. So that's another thing, you know, I'm not my own entrepreneur. My brother is in there with me and he supports me, and he's very much my opposite. He's very, you know, secure. He doesn't like making quick decisions. He's kind of likes things the way they are and stuff like that. Whereas I'm constantly, let's do this, let's try and do something else, let's try something else. So I think he balances me. I think that's very important. And he's an expert in food. I'm not. But I'm kind of good on the business side and stuff like that. So I think the two of us complement each other. So that really was a big support. I don't know how I would have handled it if I didn't have anybody with me, you know. And I suppose I'm like that in lots of other business. I always like to, you know, have that support network with me. You know, other entrepreneurs might be different in terms that they like just being completely like a lone wolf. That's not really me, you know. I need that support. So he kind of kept those things going and working, and allowed me to kind of focus the time to get that business working right.
How did you find the rhythm to work together? Because I'd imagine as brothers, it can be a little bit tough.
Oh, we have killed each other over the past. We actually now, over the last, maybe it's just we're getting a bit older, but when we first started, we used to absolutely murder each other. Yeah. Have like physical fights and stuff like that, you know. Yeah,
the only person you can't fire.
Well, that's it.
Definitely can't get rid of him.
You can't. I mean, I think it's, definitely, like, that's other things we've experienced in businesses. You know, you don't want to get too many people get too many people involved. You should really try and keep it to as few people as absolutely as possible. Because you will have differences of opinions. And when there's money on the line, obviously, you know, those differences are accentuated. So myself and my brother have huge differences of opinion. We will fight like cats and dogs at times. But at the end of the day, we're attached to the hip and we're family, so we can't get away with it. And that's it.
Do you have a process for resolving that? Do you have a thing you do, or you just...
No. Just, I mean, like, there has been the times where we haven't talked to each other for 3 or 4 months. Not now in a long time.
Okay.
But in the early days, we wouldn't have talked for 3 or 4 months. And then, I mean, he wouldn't be one for saying sorry or anything like that either. So generally, I kind of just let it slide and just try and get on with it.
He doesn't listen to podcasts, does he?
I'm going to get him to listen to this one, so he knows how tortured I've been over these years.
I made it through. So Lots & Co., how much of your headspace did that take up then during that time?
100%. And it can be, you know, it can be detrimental to relationships and all that kind of stuff that you would have at the time. It's very, you're trying to spin an awful lot of plates and things like that. And just, there's just so much stress going on. Sometimes, you know, in the past, I would have let that, you know, affect what I was going. So, I mean, that's something I learned from that experience, is that, you know, it, your life is actually more important. So just be careful not to bite off too more than you can chew all at the same time, because it can be. But I think I've grown up and learned from that experience and stuff like that as well. So, Grony, if you're listening, this one, my business won't affect us.
New man. What age were you when you started Lots & Co?
When I started juniors, I was 26. When I started Lots & Co, I would have been 33.
Okay.
33 years of age, yeah.
So you're still going through those kind of formative years of entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I'm still going through them, I suppose, yeah. But yeah, I think I'm a little bit longer in the tooth and a little bit wiser now in terms of what we take on. And, you know, I think luckily, you know, as time goes by, you become a little bit more financially secure, so you can offload an awful lot of the stuff that you would have to have done to other people. Money does help, you know, to kind of make things a little bit more secure. Obviously, you don't want to waste it, but, you know, it can... You can pay people to do certain things rather than trying to do 50 different jobs yourself.
I always think back to that quote. I must go and check who said it, but it's, if you have a problem that can be solved with money, you don't have a problem.
Exactly.
As long as you have money, of course.
Yeah.
So third business up and running.
Yeah.
How long until you got the itch again?
Well, no. So, I mean, so we opened Lots & Co in 2015, and then in 2017, I was approached by Paul Lawless and Louis Williams. And Louis was the manager of a cafe at 250 Square. They're a bit of a chain and a producer now, but at this stage. But then they had a cafe in Rathmines. And his employer used to want him to email the orders to his wholesale suppliers because he wanted to have some sort of traceability over what was being ordered. You know, Louis was just wasting a lot of time every evening, sending the same emails day in, day out. And he kind of collaborated with Paul, because Louis is a really good product designer. And they created this simple little app where he could just create the products that he needed. And then he could hit send, choose the quantities and hit send to the wholesale supplier. And they would deliver it to the supplier in a text message or an email.
Brilliant.
And this was all of a sudden, it saved him loads of time every evening. And then he kind of collaborated with Paul again and said, you know, so that he could add other members of his organization so that they could send orders, or he could assign responsibility for them to send orders, and he could see from remotely what they'd ordered. And all of a sudden, this is giving him an oversight, saving him time and giving him information about his business that he didn't currently have. And then they looked into, you know, did a bit of research and realized there was nobody really in the world who was doing anything like that, you know, or certainly not in any kind of a simplistic, easy, user-friendly kind of way. You know, there were systems, but they're very like accountancy-based. So they approached me, and they knew I owned a couple of different businesses, said, would you be interested in trialing this in your various businesses? And I looked at it straight away, and, you know, which is, if you think about it, it's crazy that all small businesses and restaurants would have a cash register for their sales. They'd have a staff rostering system for their staff. But in terms of the purchasing, they've no information whatsoever. So I kind of recognized that. I said, well, I'm not interested in trying this. I'm interested in investing in it. And I invested a very small amount of money at that time. And what we did was, you actually used to sit with the chefs in juniors and look at how they placed the orders, and then kind of refined the platform that had already been built to how they did it, rather than building the platform and giving it to the chefs, because I knew that this thing had to be super simple and really easy to use, because if it was any more difficult or any more complicated than pick up a telephone, people would just continue to pick up a telephone.
Yeah.
And it had to be extremely reliable. So we did that, and then we started sending the orders out to our wholesale suppliers, and they started actually getting in touch with us and said, what is this system that you're using? Because the ordering process for the wholesale supplier is a complete nightmare. They're receiving hundreds of voicemails every evening. They're having to pay people to come in at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, listen to these voicemails, transcribe them out in pen and paper, hand that piece of paper to somebody who then inputs it into a system, which finally produces a docket, and then they use that docket to pick the order and send it out. Now, that process is hugely costly in terms of the manual labor that it takes. It's also fraught with errors, because, you know, there's a lot of human error involved. People aren't specific enough in terms of what they want to order. You might say, I want a box of tomatoes. They don't know that supplier, that fruit and veg supplier, might have 20 different variants of tomatoes, you know. there's a lot more foreign nationals. So the person placing the order could be from, say, South America. The person receiving the order could be from Eastern Europe or even Ireland or whatever it might be. And so they're very difficult trying to understand what they're trying to order. So it's breakdown in communication. So we were able to then go into the wholesale supplier, digitize their product brochure, put it into their customers' hands 24/7.
Okay.
They're able to communicate special offers and new products, so that help to increase their sales, help to reduce their waste by eliminating all those human errors. And then we were able to integrate our application into their back-end system, so they didn't have to pay any of the people to listen to those voicemails and stuff like that. So we were helping them save money, reduce costs, reduce carbon footprint, and eliminate errors. So it was a win for the wholesale supplier, and it was a win for the buyer. And by fixing the ordering for buyers and suppliers, buyers being restaurants, cafes and bars, and suppliers being wholesale suppliers, we actually started to create a network of buyers and suppliers, which has allowed them to connect and start doing business in a completely new way. Because I had just been to a fair in Paris for Lots & Co. Called CL in Paris. And it's, just to give you an idea of the size, there's 8 halls, and each hall is about 8 times the size of the RDS. So it's absolutely massive. Wow. And the whole point of that is producers and suppliers of goods go there to meet buyers of goods. And I also recognize that when we started fixing for buyers and suppliers, there's no network that exists in Europe or anywhere really in the world that connects wholesale buyers and suppliers. And this is an industry that's worth about €500 billion a year.
And it just seems so obvious. Even as you're explaining to me, I have zero food experience, zero beverage experience. It just seems so obvious.
Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the main things that when we used to go around, you know, doing demonstrations and things like that, people would say, how has this not existed already? Now, what does exist is suppliers, you know, recognize the problems around their ordering and the process and looking for a fix. And what they would do is look to develop their own platform. Mm. But they could spend, you know, north of €100,000 to do that. And then at the same time, then my chef or my manager would have 8 different applications for 8 different suppliers. And there's nothing in it for me as a business owner to tell them to do that. The only thing that makes sense for me is to have one platform that warehouses all of that information in relation to my purchasing in one place. So that's it. And that's really been since 2018 when I really got involved in Unify Ordering. That's been my main passion because I just think the opportunity is massive. The scalability is like nothing else that I'm involved in. I just think it's a great journey to be on, and the opportunity is huge.
I love, just to break it down for people, I love how you hacked it together first. You literally went and watched the chefs to see how they do it. I think that's the step so many entrepreneurs miss. Mm-hmm. They develop the solution without looking to see how it'll be adopted.
Yeah, and understanding, I mean, that's something that we've learned really from 2018 on, and that's also my own experience. Like, I've worked every different position within the buyer side, the restaurant side, whether it be manager, kitchen porter, barista, all this kind of stuff. So understanding all of the different stakeholders and what they need and what's their problem and what's in it for me, for each one of those people, you need to understand that to fix it, you know. And then on the supplier side, we've spent the last 3 years researching, you know, person who answers the telephone, the salesperson, the business owner, all of those things and all of those different people, and creating a unified solution that fixes the problem for all of those different stakeholders is been the thing we've learned, and that's what we're building on.
It seems to be a massive opportunity, but also a massive challenge. So how are you trying to bring all those parts together? How are you trying to bring, because you have to sell to individual restaurants and you also have to get all the suppliers on board. So how
no,
do you...
We don't really sell to individual restaurants at all. We would do a bit of kind of marketing and stuff like that. We don't actually sell to restaurants because how it works is... the problem for the wholesale supplier in terms of, you know, the ordering process and lack of information in real time and all this kind of stuff and inability to communicate special offers, inability to communicate full stop really with the customers without a sales rep knocking on, you know, doors and, you know, that's not really extremely efficient way. And so lots of benefits. We explain the benefits to the wholesale supplier. They can come on for free and digitize their product brochure with images and invite their customers for free and then receive those orders in a nicely formatted email. That's all for free. Or else if they want to come on for the paid version, they can communicate special offers. They can add their sales team. We can also integrate into their back-end system. And that's what they pay us for. So they actually, we onboard the supplier and then they invite their customers. And then those customers can send orders back to that wholesale supplier. And then they can also start sending orders to their other suppliers. And then those suppliers will generally get in touch with us. What's your solution? Again, yada, yada, yada. We explain the thing. And then they invite. So we outsource a lot of our customer acquisition costs to the actual suppliers. So they sell our product for us a lot of the time.
I like
but
it.
It's in everyone's benefit. I would like to say we're not in the business of creating winners and losers. We're in the solutions business for both parties, you know.
What's been the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge? I suppose it's just a huge mammoth undertaking. And I mean, I've never been involved in a business where one minute, like this is tech startups, one minute you're like, yeah, I'm the next Mark Zuckerberg, and the next minute you can't even log into the app or won't do something, you know. You're just like, this is just like, I'm used, what am I wasting all my time for? But I mean, like, I suppose what keeps you going is the belief in the vision and the reassurance that you get from the customers and the users who do it. It's not doing everything that we wanted to do right now. I mean, I still think it's kind of in its infancy. We're on the supplier side, we're really kind of revolutionizing those businesses, allowing them to grow, reduce costs. I think we need to go and do that for the restaurant side. And that's by giving them greater user controls, allowing them to check in their orders and, you know, using the checked in orders to export that information to their accounting system or the bookkeeping system, so that, or their POS system, to eliminate bookkeeping, giving them information about price increases, price decreases, how to run their business more efficiently. And I think if we can revolutionize on both sides of the platform, then we're going to create this machine that will spawn and grow naturally. Now it's grown massively and it's really, but I think we can bring the level of growth up to a completely different level. And then we are very ambitious to move abroad, start bringing this solution and really create a great Irish company in the UK, the US, all over the world.
At what stage is it now? So it started in 2018 with the two lads, was it?
Well, we launched an MVP to the market really in 2018 and we hired our first staff member. A sales guy called Rich O'Driscoll, who's just an unbelievable self-starter, did a great job. And look, when we launched in 2018, we kind of thought we had a fully finished product. We were nowhere near. We needed to really kind of learn the market. We're still really, you know, we have a lot of work to do in getting the product to the final end game of where we want to do. But I think we can get there in the next 6-9 months. And then once that's done, I just honestly think it will sell itself. And we could just drop it into new locations and just watch the model grow again, because we started in Dublin in 2018 with very poor functionality, no user journey, no onboarding process, no supplier directory, no nothing. And we started 3 years ago with one supplier and 40 customers. We now have about over 300 suppliers receiving orders on the platform, nearly 3,000 restaurants using it, food buyers, cafes, bars, retailers, whatever it might be. So it's really going to gain in huge traction. We're doing about 12 million euros worth of orders every month. The potential is really starting to kind of culminate now. So another few months, I think it could be even bigger.
So you're 3 years in, it's time to start a new business.
No. Well, there's nothing. And I think, you know, it takes a restaurant about 6 months before you're fully up and running. You've ironed out all the kinks and you're firing all cylinders. It took nearly a year in the grocery shop. I don't know what it takes. You know, we still haven't. No, we
probably never get there. Yeah.
No. Yeah. And it's a lot harder. You know, you need to spend good money developing it out. It's just so multifaceted, the job, in terms of like dealing with investors, dealing with the team, dealing with the product, selling the vision, keeping the thing on track. And it's just, you're just spinning so many plates and just trying to keep everything on the right track, you know.
Talk to me about that. Talk to me about how you manage such a wide variety of businesses. I know you're saying you've got great people, but you know, you seem to be still involved. How do you manage this process? How do you manage yourself, I guess, is what I'm asking you.
Well, like in the restaurants, we have really good managers and stuff that have been there a long time. Now, saying that, we're in the process of kind of giving juniors a bit of a relaunch and changing it in the evening time, and you know, just reopening it after COVID. But yeah, I mean, I suppose a lot of the time, never try and be like too good at a job that you want somebody else to do. So I kind of get myself in there, I'll get it moving, and then I'll try and extricate myself in the process. That was kind of the way I was. I would normally, when I'd open a new business, I'd get in there and I'd work furiously at it, get it up and running, and then just try and extricate myself in the process and delegate and bring management in. Yes, I mean, they're not, we've opened new outlets of Lots & Co, but it's not a new business to a certain extent. You know, there might be new outlets, but it doesn't require that furious energy to come in for 6-9 months to kind of be watching absolutely everything. And then, yeah, you just have to have good management and good staff to kind of, that you can rely on to pick up the pieces, so you don't have to be looking at it, you know. But in terms of how do I manage my day today, I probably do, you know, one day a week of meetings for the various different businesses, just making sure everything's working, looking at the margins and all that kind of jazz. And the rest of my time is spent day and night on Uniflooring, because, as I said, it's my real passion. And I just think it can in its own small way change the world a little bit, you know, for the better. Allow businesses, you know, independently owned businesses to be efficient, whether that's on the restaurant side or the supplier side, which will allow them to stay in business. And then, you know, reducing kind of the carbon footprint of the industry by eliminating redeliveries, eliminating physical product brochures. And we think, you know, it can eliminate paper invoicing as well. So it could effectively eliminate paper from that entire side of the industry, because we're called Unify Ordering, but ordering really is just the main thing that we do, and that allows us access to the market. We believe we can change how buyers and suppliers in that industry meet, connect, start doing business, through to how those goods are communicated and advertised to the person, through to how those goods are the orders are received, through to how the goods are actually delivered, all the way through to how the goods are paid for at the end. And we think we can digitize that whole pipeline. So again, it's not a small undertaking that we're trying to do. It's not like we have a little widget. So it's a big undertaking. It requires a lot of work, and it's required making a lot of mistakes and learning an awful lot over the last few years. But I think we've really learned all those lessons, and now it's just time to go on and execute and make it happen.
In terms of the rest of your week, how do you have a work-life balance? You've kind of mentioned it there. You work day and night. Do you have a balance?
Yeah, I would. I would work. I'm a kind of more of a late night person than an early morning person. So people who work with me will know that I'm very fond of sending emails at like 1 o'clock.
Oh, you're that dreaded person
in the morning.
Pings the inbox.
Because I'm more of a late night person. Maybe it's from working in restaurants for years.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I'll come home normally around 5 o'clock. I train. I like to try and stay fit as much as I possibly can.
What do you do?
At the moment, I have one of the guys who is the kitchen porter in Juniors is also a personal trainer, and he kind of helped me out during lockdown. We used to train up in the park, and I've kind of stuck with him. I used to do CrossFit. I might go back to that at some point. I probably need to get a little bit fitter before I go back to do that. But yeah, that's it. I'll probably look to train 2 or 3 nights a week. I like, you know, going out for dinner with my fiance and meeting up with friends at the weekend. So nothing too extraordinary. I don't live any sort of a mad life. It certainly seems a bit quieter now since post-COVID. I'm looking forward to starting to be able to travel again and things like that as well. So
it's a new record for the pod. We've made it 41 minutes without being able to talk about COVID. So let's do a quick segment, because I think it's pertinent to the business you're in. I think you might be able to shed some light on it for people who aren't in the business and people who are in the business. What's been happening for you? So just bring me through COVID quite quickly, and then bring me through your outlook for the next kind of
period. So, you know, luckily we diversified into the grocery business during COVID, because, you know, obviously the restaurant industry was extremely hard hit. We are fortunate again, and I seem to get lucky a good bit, that a lot of the food that we do in our restaurants was affords itself or lends itself to takeout. So in Paulie's Pizza, obviously pizza is perfect for takeout, and we were one of the few restaurants, we never closed one day in Paulie's. I actually used to put a couple of shifts right at the beginning.
Wow.
And that was crazy, you know, like people used to be coming up, you know, we didn't know whether this thing was the plague or not like that, and we're still serving, and then like the staff were all very nervous and things like that, but we managed to sell. We did close Juniors for 3 weeks, and then we relaunched that pretty soon afterwards. I think the government supports have been pretty good, you know, in terms of they've certainly kept the wolf just that bit from the door. You know, obviously, some people have been more hard hit than others. But I would be concerned about a lot of places whenever these subsidies do go off, because we kind of entered into a bit of a false economy in the restaurant industry.
Break that down for people, because I think people in business don't get that. I was having this conversation with someone recently. I was trying to like open the kimono a wee bit and kind of show them, going, look, a lot of businesses are just barely surviving with the subsidies. So how do you...
Yeah, I mean, a lot of places are just kind of breaking even with the subsidies. But also, the other huge problem within the industry is trying to get staff. So, I mean, floor staff, kitchen staff, all this kind of stuff, kitchen porters. You know, you just can't operate without a kitchen porter in a restaurant. So we have... situation now where, you know, the people are paying, you know, staff mad money, say 15, 16 euros an hour for a kitchen porter. They can do that now because the government is probably paying a large proportion. But when that government subsidy goes off, you know, unless you want to be paying, you know, 10, 12 quid for a sandwich, then, you know, those people aren't going to be able to get paid that amount of money, you know. And it's not about restaurateurs being greedy, just about the margins have got to add up. So so that's kind of coming down the track.
Where does that lead though, Barry, in your opinion? Where does this go?
Well, I think there is price inflation all over the place, and I think it's just going to have to keep filtering down to the end customer. So I do think you're going to see price increases on menus. We're seeing price increases in absolutely everything, all over the board, across the board. So anyway, that's what's really kind of going on in the restaurant industry. But I think, you know, good operators will survive, and I think it'll be a good opportunity for new people to enter the industry. So it's not all doom and gloom by any stretch of the imagination. During COVID as well, we had lots of co-grocery, and that side of the business absolutely flourished. So obviously everybody was at home cooking meals, and people also seem to be wanting to eat nice quality stuff and spending an extra few quid on the bottle of wine and all this kind of stuff because they couldn't eat out in restaurants. So we were very, very fortunate on that side. And we were, you know, we actually opened a new store in Clontarf right in the middle last November. And again, that business probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for COVID.
Okay.
Because the previous owners, you know, closed for whatever reason. And I saw that it was vacant, and we just went for it and got it. So that was it.
That restlessness again. Spotting new opportunities.
I always liked that location in Clontarf. It's right in the seafront. It's got great street presence. And I was out cycling my bike, and I just saw it was closed. And I said, oh, geez, that place is closed. I always wanted. And through one thing or another, I managed to get in touch with the landlord, and we were able to do a deal. So I saw it in June or July, and we had opened by November. So it was really quick turnaround, you know, ahead of Christmas.
What was it like working during COVID, getting that place open?
Well, it was kind of touch and go. We didn't know whether the building site was going to get closed down and all this kind of stuff. Like we were very lucky. I think probably we got to finish November. Then I think, you know, building works were not happening in January. I can't even remember what the different restrictions were at different times. But yeah, we sat in the window perfectly and finished the job, got it open. And then, you know, it was like we were opening a nightclub or something there, because nobody had anything to do. It was like, oh my God, a new supermarket's opening, a new shop where I can go to.
We were starved.
People were queuing for mad amounts of time and stuff like that, which was great. But I mean, it was really cold and everything. I mean, I'm not sure if I would have queued that long, but I think people were just curious. They had time to kill. Yeah. And so they came in. So we're opening a third store of Lots & Co. in Terran Yor, not this Friday, soon enough, anyway, the 8th of October. So yeah, and then that'll be it, absolutely. No new services next year. But then I really just want to focus my energies on Unify and getting that.
So what does the future look like for Unify? What's the plan for the next kind of 12 to 18 months?
So, I mean, what we're looking to raise money at the moment. We're kind of getting really good conversations with a lot of different good investors and VCs and stuff. So I'm pretty confident that will come to pass. And then we really want to just devote all of our time to really just developing out the tech, spending all of our resources on building out that tech. You know, as I mentioned, improving the supplier side and the buyer side, bringing some, you know, payments onto the platform. And then we want to hit some geographic locations within the UK. And then if we can do that and increase the value of the transactions on the platform, and you know, our monthly recurring revenue that we're making, we would look to do then a Series A in about 12 to 14 months time. And I think we could, if we can hit all those milestones and KPIs that we're just talking, could be at an absolutely massive valuation, because there's other similar companies in Europe and in the US, and we're doing not too far off what they're doing, and they've raised at ridiculous valuations. So I think, you know, why can't we do it? Mm. And I always say, you know, this is the future of how orders will be sent, because there's just too many advantages for the restaurant in terms of having all that information in one place. And there's too many advantages for the supplier in terms of being able to come on board with very few startup costs and having a system that works with them out of the box that their customers will actually use, for it not to be. So it's going to be either us who does it or a company from Silicon Valley. So I'm just like, fuck it, why can't it be us? I think we have the skill set and the knowledge and the industry experience to make it happen.
It's exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dust off your crystal ball for me there and tell me what trends excite you. I know you're not going to start a new business, but any aspiring entrepreneurs out there looking at you going, ah, oh, he has a finger in the pulse. What else excites you?
I don't know. Really, you know, I'm very heavily invested in the food and drinks industry. Yeah.
Even within that industry, is there things that you like that you're seeing in the industry now kind of going, oh, that's pretty interesting? Or even what do you think will happen post-COVID in the industry?
Yeah, I think if I have to think about what would happen post-COVID, I think there's going to be possibly a kind of a polarization within the industry where it's going to be experiential, kind of high-end type restaurants, or else it's going to be kind of single concept, whether it be one place just doing burgers or just doing, you know, tuna ceviche, whatever it might be, but those kind of things. And then it'll be those two extremes. So that's what I see. I can't really, what I'm passionate about, I'm really, all of my passion is kind of developed into getting unified to where it can be, because that's really, that's kind of what keeps me awake at night and keeps me excited and gets my blood going. And then obviously over the next year or two, I'm going to get married and stuff like that. So
that'll keep you a little bit busy.
That'll keep me busy for a moment. Yeah.
Is there something you've changed your mind about since you started as an entrepreneur? Is there something you firmly believed or had an impression of before you started and now you're kind of going, that is not even close to the truth?
Yeah, I suppose before I started, you know, you kind of think it's a lot more difficult than it is. I'd done a master's degree in finance and I'd done BCom, and I always thought it's crazy that they never told you like just the basic things about how to start a business in terms of like how to get VAT registered and all this kind of stuff, you know, and that can seem insurmountable. But I would say, you know, if you're really passionate about starting, reach out to people. People are a lot more accommodating and will give you time. And I would think a lot of entrepreneurs really actually like to see other people giving it a go and stuff like that. So try and reach out and build your network as much as you possibly can. And lean on people for advice and things like that. And then the other thing as well is just be realistic, but be determined. And just, I think it's the perseverance and the resilience is probably the most important characteristic that you need in order to be successful. Because, you know, every time you fail, you're running basically an experiment. And if it works, it works. If it fails, it fails. And you move on to the next experiment and just keep doing that. And if you can keep you know, performing as many experiments as possible, you're going to start to realize what the right way forward is. That's it.
That's beautiful, Barry. We'll end on that because that's the whole genesis of this podcast. That's what it's all about. You tied that in lovely there, Barry.
I didn't know. That was pure serendipity.
Barry, where can people go to learn more about Unify and then the other businesses as well?
Yeah, well, if you want to learn more about Unify, go to the unifyordering.com. You can look at the website there. It'll explain the different benefits for both parties, buyers and suppliers within the industry. You can also just go directly to the App Store if you're a restaurant or a food purchaser. And it's not just restaurants. It's restaurants, bars, retailers. We have nursing homes, tennis clubs, anybody who purchases wholesale food for whatever reason. You can go there. You can download it, get registered, connect with all your suppliers, add as many other users within your organization, and it's super simple to get started. So those are the ways to come and find us.
Class. Barry, thank you so much for your time.
Cool. Thank you.
How about that for a chat? Barry is the real deal. If I had a VC fund, or if I had any funds at all, I would be putting a lot of it into Unify. They are a business that we're going to be hearing a lot about in the next couple of years. Hope you enjoyed that chat. I will see you back here next Monday for an Idea Lab. In the meantime, have an incredible week.